In association with Pharma Nor Nutritional Supplements, you're listening to the Book of the Month live from the Book Corner in Saltburn.
This month's book is Saturday Night and Sunday Morning by Alan Sillitoe. Saturday Night and Sunday Morning is Alan Sillitoe's first novel, published in 1958. Set in post-war Nottingham, it follows a year in the life of Arthur Seaton, a young man who works in the bicycle factory, turning out parts on a lathe. Arthur is in his early 20s, single and very much fancy-free. He works hard all week, earning enough to drink himself into oblivion on Friday and Saturday nights. He also has an eye for the ladies, particularly young married women, and when the book opens he is busy drinking with Brenda, the wife of a colleague. Despite his genuine affection for Brenda, Arthur also embarks on an occasional affair with her sister Winnie, who is also married. Ignoring warnings from friends and family, Arthur continues along his reckless path until Winnie's soldier husband Bill and one of his friends corner him outside a pub and beat him almost senseless.
Arthur started with the firm as a messenger boy, carrying samples of bicycle parts from one branch of the factory to another, or doing errands around the city on a carrier bike. He was 15 at the time, and every Thursday morning, Robbo sent him on a mysterious errand to a chemist's shop downtown, giving him a sealed envelope with a note and some money inside. Arthur reached the shop after an interesting and idling ride along canal banks and through narrow streets, and the chemist handed him a stronger, brown envelope containing something flat and sponge-like, and the change from the money in the first envelope. After 3 months of such journeys, Arthur discovered what Robbo sent him to buy, because one morning the chemist was in too much of a hurry to see that the envelope was firmly sealed, so Arthur was able to open it while waiting for the traffic lights to change, to see what was inside and seal it again, this time securely. He found what he had expected to find, and rode his bike back along Castle Boulevard, laughing like a maniac, overtaking buses, milk carts, even cars in his furious speed. Everyone stared at him as if he had gone mad. "Three packets," he shouted out. "The dirty bugger! He's got a fancy woman! 9 times a week! So the news broke in the shop, and long afterwards, when Arthur had been taken off the messenger job and put on a drill, if he left his machine to walk out to the lavatory, someone would shout, "Where are you going, Arthur?" And if Robbo was not in the shop, he would yell back at the top of his voice, "I'm going downtown to get Robbo's rubbers!" in his broad, deliberately brutalised Robin Hood accent that brought screams of laughter from the women and guffaws from the men. Robbo stopped at his machine, picked up a piece of finished work, and checked its size carefully with a micrometer. Arthur paused while turning the capstan. "All right," he asked belligerently. Robbo, always with a cigarette in his mouth, blew smoke away from his eyes, and ash fell onto his brown overall coat. He made the last measurement with a depth gauge. "Yes," he said. "Nothing wrong." And walked off. Arthur and Robbo tolerated and trusted each other. The enemy in them stayed dormant, a black animal stifling the noise of its growls as if commanded by a greater master to lie low, an animal that had perhaps been passed on for some generations from father to son on either side. They respected this lineage in each other, recognised it when they asked or answered tersely the few brusque questions that passed between them, speaking with loud mouths and passionless eyes. Robbo had a car, admitted an ancient Morris, and a semi-detached in a posh district. And Arthur held these pretensions against him because, basically, they were of equal stock. And he would therefore have felt friendlier had Robbo lived in the same kind of four-roomed house as himself. For Robbo was in no way better than him, he ruminated, spinning the turret and lightly applying its chamfer tool to one of the last dozen cylinders of the day. And no better than anybody else if it came to that. Arthur did not assess men on their knowledge or achievements, but by a blind and passionate method that weighed their more basic worth. It was an emotional gauge, always accurate when set by him, and those to whom it was applied either passed or did not pass the test. Within the limits of its narrow definitions, he used it as a reliable guide as to who was and who was not his friend, and up to what point he could trust a person who might become his friend. So, when Arthur looked at a man, or heard the inflection in his voice, or saw him walk, he made a snap judgment that turned out to be as accurate as one made after weeks of acquaintance. His first assessment of Robbo never altered. In fact, it had gained ground. His half-conscious conclusions proved to him that no one man was better than the other in this particular case, that they shared with plain openness a world of enmity that demanded a certain amount of trust. And Arthur did not doubt that Robbo had applied a similar test to him, with the same conclusions. So the respect they had for each other was based on a form of judgment that neither could give words to. Whenever Arthur looked up into somebody's face and screwed up his brows to look black and cunning and shouted, "I've got you weighed up," the chances were that he really did have their main characteristics balanced nicely on the scales in his mind, although he could explain neither the mechanism of the scales nor the nature of the goods that kept each pan level.
This novel is generally placed alongside works such as Osborne's play, Look Back in Anger, John Brain's Room at the Top, and Sillitoe's second novel, The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, to exemplify the work of the so-called angry young men. This title was given to a number of young, mainly working class or lower middle class writers, primarily, though not exclusively male, who expressed their anger at the continuing control of the establishment over life and politics in 1950s and 60s Britain. Sillitoe never embraced this label, and his work differs from many of these other writers who tend to have aspirational heroes at their core. Arthur Seton has no desire to raise his social standing. He is happy where he is, contemptuous of those scrabbling for approval from the boss or a supervisor's job. After completing his national service, he'd like to blow up the factory, the bosses, and the whole establishment. He is a fighter, but only for pride or self-defence. His life is bound by the routine of work, drinking, and quiet Sunday afternoons fishing out of town. There is nothing of the political rebel or social climber about Arthur.
Because Arthur was tall, they put him in the military police, gave him a whistle and a red cap, and stood him up like a pit prop to check the passes of the lucky ones as they went out on pass or leave. He was a red cap. What irony. It was the joke of the family, but he fretted all the time. He was paid 5 bob a day and thought bitterly of the £2 earned at his lathe. But let them start a war, he thought, and see what a bad soldier I can be. Them at the top must know that nobody would fight. And he supposed that because of this they weren't so anxious to rely on them in another war. In the army it was, "F you, Jack, I'm all right." Out of the army it was, "Every man for himself." It amounted to the same thing. Opinions didn't matter. Intelligent cooperation meant falling for a slipknot, getting yourself caught in a half Nelson, though he knew a way to get free from both. The only peace you got was when you were away from it all, sitting on the osier-lined banks of a canal waiting for fish to bite, or lying in bed with a woman you loved. They were angling for another war now, with the Russians this time. But they did go as far as to promise that it would be a short one, a few big flashes and it would all be over. What a lark. We'd be fighting side by side with the Germans that had been bombing us in the last war. What did they take us for? Bloody fools. One of these days they'd be wrong. They think they've settled our hashes with their insurance cards and television sets. But I'll be one of them to turn round on them and let them see how wrong they are. When I'm on my 15 days training and I lay on my guts behind a sandbag shooting at a target board, I know whose faces I've got in my sights every time the new rifle cracks off. Yes, the bastards that put the gun into my hands. I make up a quick picture of their stupid four-eyed faces that blink as they read big books and papers on how to get blokes into khaki and fight battles in a war that they'll never be in, and then I let fly at them. Crack, 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 crack. Other faces as well. The snot-gibbling get that takes my income tax. The swivel-eyed swine that collects our rent. The big-headed bastard that gets my goat when he asks me to go to union meetings or sign a paper against what's happening in Kenya. As if I cared. He remembered his father digging up the back garden to plant an Anderson's shelter, Arthur stumbling into the hole and getting a clout for doing so, and later the family sat on the planks inside, coughing from the damp, moist soil, scratching their scabied bodies and listening to the weird-sounding hollowness of the naval guns behind Beechdale Woods. His white-faced father rushing in at midnight, a teapot in one hand and half a dozen cups strung along the fingers of the other, having braved falling shrapnel to mash back just in time to escape the jerry plane that sprayed the factory with its machine guns. In the long, high-pitched whistle of a bomb, the whole world was caught and suspended. So that you just wondered, 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 keeping quite still during the whistle, not breathing, not moving a finger, your eyes open wide, until the explosion on the railway yards or on the back of houses in the next street made you glad to be still alive. And when he came to think of it, Ada's sons had not done too badly. At the end of the war, they were rounded up for the last time and dumped into the glass house. Dave was sent to the BLA 6 months before D-Mob. The war was over. And in Berlin, he met Arthur's sister, Margaret, who worked as a waitress with the Naffy. And they walked arm in arm along the Unter den Linden, pointing out the ruins, talking of old times, drinking strong beer, and laughing at the thought that they, of all people, should meet among the smashed streets of Berlin, of all places.
The novel paints a vivid picture of life in the post-war era, with Nottingham, then an important industrial centre, at its heart. In truth, apart from the famous Goose Fair that features in one chapter, it could be set in any city of the time. Rather than diminishing the book, this makes it more powerful, and Arthur, though not a pleasant individual at times, is an engaging everyman. Much of the story, seem almost exclusively from his point of view, is told through Arthur's thoughts, and although some of the language he uses and the ideas he harbours are no longer deemed acceptable in our era, the result is a powerful and honest portrait of the time. This is a very difficult trick for a writer, and Sillitoe manages it almost effortlessly. In places, the quality of his writing belies the fact this is a first novel. Recently reissued to celebrate 50 years since publication, this is a book that shows us an often hidden world, somewhere we might have walked past oblivious. It is as vivid and honest as the day of its first publication, and possibly just as relevant.
And we're back. It's the Book of the Month live at the Book Corner in Saltburn. We're delighted that Jenna Warren, the owner of the Book Corner, is with us. How are you, Jenna?
I'm fine. I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. We've also got the fabulous Rob Nichols with us, stalwart of the Book of the Month, although you were absent last week. Good to have you back, Rob, as ever.
Thank you.
And, of course, Jenny, our host and co-author of everything, really, but obviously the Book of the producer and so on. Jenna, let's come to you first from that point of view, because you're gracious enough to actually host the Book of the Month live for the second time. Saturday night and Sunday morning, not quite 50 years as yet, but how did it resonate for your good self? Because I suspect you're probably the youngest of us, really.
Right. Well, to be honest, when I first started reading it, during the first chapter, there was a sort of moment when I was thinking, can I actually stand to spend 200 pages in the company of this character? But after a couple of chapters, it really started to draw me in. I mean, as Jenny said, even though he's not always, he's hardly ever a sympathetic character, at least in my opinion, he is a very engaging one. And I was really drawn in by him and the sense of place, and the sense of a period that maybe, you know, obviously I don't know a great deal about at all, and I think I really enjoyed just the vividness of the writing, even if I couldn't really sort of empathise with most of the characters, so much to my surprise, I really enjoyed it.
Okay, excellent. Rob?
Yeah, it is. I think it was really good. When you see anything on television or hear anything about the 50s, it's about it's the rock and roll era, isn't it? And this is very much as Jenny said, this is the people that lived in the street houses that are still there in any town. But this is the story of it's the end of an era, isn't it? When parlours were still parlours, and people worked in the factory for life and could earn a lot of money through piecework, and it's a period that you don't hear much about because it's after the war, but rationing is just finishing, really, isn't it? So hence maybe the anti-establishment of the all that time after the war and you're still on rations. It's really interesting to read about, and yeah, obviously he's not a very sympathetic character, but that makes him more real, doesn't it, in many respects.
The phrase "don't let the bastards get you down" is one which is constantly inscribed in my own mind over careers in all sorts of ways. And it's also channeling the line of Albert Finney in, obviously, the movie version of this particular thing, where I think he really captured the line of Arthur Seddon, you know, perfectly. And yet, despite the fact that the critics loved it, is it, or can it be accused of being a kind of middle-class view of the working class, or a new middle-class view of the working class, if we were actually being sort of tense about the whole thing? Jenny, what do you think about that? I mean, the notion that actually Sillitoe, as you said in the sort of opening sort of sequences, a bit like John Osborne, etc., they kind of benefited from the fact that this was the first time a generation of what would presumably have been lower middle class folk could actually go off and begin to start carving out their careers as writers, creators and artists.
Well, Sillitoe differs from a lot of the others in that he left school at 14. He did work in this bicycle factory. He lived in Nottingham. He wrote the book after he'd left, and he went abroad for 6 years. So he wrote it when he was away from Nottingham.
In order to fund him going back to Spain, I believe.
Well, yes. But I think Sillitoe is one of the most authentic of them all. Some of the others you stand and look at now and you think, no, there's definitely a sort of lower middle class aspirational thing. It's particularly with John Osborne. When I was younger, I read them all. I read particularly Keith Waterhouse, and I loved Billy Lyre. But you have got that aspirational, it will be better if we were middle class sense in the others, and you don't have in Sillitoe's work. And that makes it, I think, particularly powerful.
Jenna, the female characters in the book, interesting portrayal in all sorts of ways. I mean, obviously, you know, too many spoilers, but Arthur actually does meet up with both two sisters, effectively, both married. There we are. How did you feel they were portrayed?
Well, I guess, I didn't find them entirely unsympathetic. I felt as though I did empathise with them, you know, a little bit. I thought they just felt, you know, quite real, not necessarily bad people, just sort of within their.
If we asked, would it be Winnie you'd go for, or would it be would it be his true love, apparently, Doreen, of course.
Doreen, definitely Doreen.
Rob, I mean, from that, because I mean, I got a sense in terms of the piece. I mean, we said, I think, in the original sort of trailer that it was really books like this that paved the way for things like Coronation Street, soap operas, etc. Yeah. Did you kind of get a sense of that coming across in terms of people having affairs and so on?
Yes, but that very much is a soap opera. But also, it just struck me that I remember going to a football match in Nottingham, and I think it was 1981, and I stayed in Nottingham that night. And I'd never been to a place where there was so many people in so many pubs, and that the city was full on the streets. After midnight, it was packed. Mm. And I know, Jenny, you were saying that this could be anywhere, but I've been to various places, like Manchester and Leeds, but I'd never been to a city that was so many people who'd been out drinking on a Saturday night. And the streets were fuller at midnight, I remember thinking, than there had been during the day when they'd been at the football match. So I thought, this place is a bit different here.
Yeah, I mean, the East Midlands was something that certainly was challenging. I mean, Derby, Nottingham, Lincoln, they all kind of had that kind of middle background where they're not. There's not the kind of northeastern passion here, although there are elements, as Rob, you said, about parlours and front rooms and so on, the kind of class system. And there's not the kind of the southern kind of Cockney, bonhomie and so on that you got there. You got something which is it something that's just quintessentially English that Sillitoe's tapped into, do you think?
I think the point about the East Midlands is a good one, but I would include the whole of the Midlands. I trained as a teacher in the mid-70s in Birmingham, and I lived in one of these tiny little houses in one of the roughest places in Birmingham, Saltley. And it was exactly like that. And once again, the streets were full after midnight, but only at the weekend.
Yeah.
And you could hear people getting up early in the morning, and there were lots of bicycles. And that world still existed in the Midlands. I don't know if it is quintessentially English. It may well be in that an awful lot of countries didn't feel the same way about the war when it was finished. People who won were quite triumphant on the continent. People who lost were very quiet about it, understandably somewhat crushed. And for a lot of British people, it was just, well, thank goodness that's over. We're not getting dragged into another one. You can just go hang.
We talked about, obviously, Sillitoe's portrayal of Arthur Seton as being kind of anti-hero. How do you think he would actually be in sort of contact? What do you think Arthur Seton would be now if he was still alive? Would he still be alive? Maybe he was in his 90s. What sort of thing would he look back on, Jenna?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I'm actually not sure. I'm not sure whether his sort of attitude towards life will have changed a great deal. I mean, he seems to have a very, as a character, I think he has a very strong sense of who he is. And I don't think he'd ever lose that. I'm not sure that sort of outside forces would change that.
You don't think he would have gone to vote for Tony Blair then? You don't think that would have probably not been
I doubt it. Yeah, I doubt it.
Jeremy Corbyn?
I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure. You're probably asking the wrong person.
Yeah. Okay. Rob? I mean, politically, because I mean, he comes across as apolitical, really.
Yeah,
basically, it's every person for himself. That's
absolutely,
that's
as in the excerpts you read. So you wonder if, obviously, I haven't read the sequel, which is several years later. Whether he changes his worldview, but he had nothing to do with politics. Were nothing to do with him there, were they?
Apart from voting communist once.
Oh yeah, yeah. He had his reasons.
Yeah. Interesting. I probably would actually say that if I was asked to really nail it down, I preferred Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. That's not to sort of say that, but I felt that, again, maybe it's because of the movie that sort of worked out on that basis. But although, again, critically very much acclaimed, they weren't hugely popular at the time, and yet they still remain so. Jenny, I mean, that kind of resonance, and what was the reason, apart from obviously its upcoming 50th anniversary sort of thing, why go for Sillitoe?
Partly because I enjoyed the whole genre so much when I was younger. It opened my eyes to an awful lot of things, having grown up in an aspirational lower middle class family that were on the clerical side, had escaped from engineering. It was very interesting for me growing up in the wilds of Essex to read about this. And partly because, to a certain extent, we don't have as many voices like this as we used to have. And I think that's our loss.
So, it's almost scores on the doors time, so to speak. Jenna, how many marks out of 10? And I know this is quantifying people and they think, oh, we can't do this. Mm. But what would you actually give for Alan Sillitoe's Saturday Night, Sunday Morning?
I would say 8.
Okay, Rob?
8.5.
I'd probably go for 8. I think I'll go with 8. And Jenny?
I'll go for 8.
Yeah, so there we are. Not with it. I mean, because the interesting thing is how Seton would have reacted to the onset of Thatcherism and the demise of all the manufacturing industry. But that's a question for another tale, I suppose. One of the reasons we're actually here, apart from obviously Jenna's wonderful largesse in sort of opening up the book corner in Saltburn, which is a sensational place, and you should visit it wherever in the world you happen to be, because it covers all sorts of magical things here, plus a lovely site of the heart of Saltburn, Jenny.
Absolutely.
But it's really the unofficial curtain raiser to what's going to be a fantastic weekend in Saltburn, because of course we've got Saltburn Food Festival, and you've got authors coming to the book corner, have you not, Jenna? Share with us who they are.
Right, I've got, basically I've got a series of 4 authors coming throughout the day. So at 11:30 I've got Jenny Finch coming in.
Jenny Finch.
She'll be here for about an hour, I think, Jenny. Yeah.
Great. She goes off at some outside broadcast reporting location things, I think, the south side probably.
Right, well that's good. I'm sorry, I'm actually looking at my blackboard to remind me who
Peter Sidwell is going to be coming.
Yes.
Cheese expert,
and he's coming at 1:30, and he's going to be signing his series of cookery books, the Simply Good cookery books.
And they're not cheesy at all, but lots of
cheese. And then sort of mid-morning, sort of between those two visitors, 12:30 in fact, lunchtime, we've got Anne Fothergill coming in, and she's a local writer who's written a series of memoirs. The first one is called Memoirs of a Nazareth House Girl, and that's about her childhood.
With the nuns?
Yes, absolutely, in Middlesbrough. Mm. And then finally at 2:30 in the afternoon, we've got Andy Willoughby coming in, and he's the former Poet Laureate of Middlesbrough, and he's got a new collection called Sampo, Heading Further North, which is written in collaboration with another local poet, Bob Beegree. So he's going to sign those and maybe read a few poems as well.
Great. course, you really need a Rob Nichols book signing as well.
Great.
To do a book first.
be sorted too. And Jenny, this Saltburn Festival, of course, you introduced us to it last year, and we thought it was fantastic then. Would you actually just plug some of the grand things, that, apart from obviously the book corner and the tremendous book signings that are going to be taking place on Sunday, the 2nd of August, day after Yorkshire Day? What better way to celebrate, you know, the post-scenario of Yorkshire Day? What sort of things will you be doing when you're on location with us, and what can we look out for around the streets of Saltburn?
Well, it's grown enormously since its original, its first festival 3 years ago. There are going to be over 70 food stalls, including world street food and a host of organic produce, wine, cheese, bread, cakes. I feel hungry just thinking about it. It's being presented in conjunction with the Refurbish Emporium, and for the first time there'll be a proper art street, and people will be able to look at arts and crafts and so on, all handmade, and have a look at some of the recycling and upcycling, they call it now, that the Refurbish Emporium do. There's going to be a children's cookery academy, which is free, and if people come along, you are strongly advised to go to the Hob Hill site and park there in the old golf course car park, because there is a vintage bus from Whitby which will be bringing you in and out of town on a free park and ride. And it's worth coming just to ride on the bus, I have to tell you, it's brilliant.
Absolutely fantastic. And you might well be joining us as one of our official celebrity reporters then.
I would love to.
Next month's book of the month is?
It is Ishiguro's wonderful dystopian novel, Never Let Me Go.